Hello, welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well, Tom. Thanks for asking, and I hope listeners at home are doing well too.
As do I. We're also delighted to be joined in this episode by James Woodhausen, a longtime contributor and friend of Spiked. How are you doing, James?
Very good.
So, James, we're going to start with you and about something that you've written about on Spiked in the past week. It's often said of this new Labour government that they don't really stand for very much. But one thing they certainly do stand for is net zero zealotry. We've seen a kind of suite of announcements already, ending the ban on onshore wind, approving solar farms in the east of England, as well as cracking down on oil and gas in the North Sea. But just, do you want to talk us through that final piece of this? Because I know that's what you've written about this week and what it reveals about our new Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, and what he plans to do.
Well, it's very easy to make fun of Ed Miliband, and one shouldn't do that. And it's also easy to make fun of people who've read politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford, and worse still, gone to the London School of Economics afterwards. So just because I have a distant physics degree, I'm not going to fault him for his poor physics. But it is a fact, as you say, Tom, that his zealotry in pursuit of net zero is part of a widespread left-ish mistake, which is that the ends always justify the means. So not many people really know what net zero carbon emissions would be like in 2050, but it doesn't matter because it must be right. And therefore, you can do the most irrational things. For example, if you take just for a moment, the photovoltaics that he wants to install, they are, like nearly everything green nowadays, made in China. Most of the stuff that's made in China is made in factories that are powered by coal-fired electricity. It wouldn't be true to say, as some overzealous critics might say, that, you know, he's going to cover Britain's farmland with solar panels. That's not true. We've got more than 90% of Britain's surface area is not industrialised. So there's a lot of countryside, or what Keir Starmer would call grey belt, to, you know, put solar panels on. Nevertheless, to buy those panels from China and to import them by sea and then to erect them, they won't really endanger our food security, but it's a very cockeyed way of trying to get rid of carbon emissions. And I think one thing we can say about it, and wind power, to which I'll turn in a second, is you have to be very naive to imagine, as it's easy to do if you have no grounding in physics or economics, that once you've paid for the capital cost of these green technologies, then wind and solar energy are free, and therefore what's not to like? You've got no labor, that's not true. You've got no maintenance, that's also not true. You've got no problems of disposal, that's not true, you do. But you seem to invest with a big capital sum up front, and then you've got infinite durability, no problems, no bird poo on the solar panels, nothing grinding the wind turbines to shreds and all of those things. So it appears plausible only if you don't do your research. And it's not a whole lot of research you have to do to find that that's not true. If briefly we turn to his fondness for wind turbines as against North Sea oil, the amount of uncertainty that surrounded the announcement that he made, or a spokesman made, saying we're not going to do X, Y, Z with the licenses, even that I won't go over because it's quite complicated. And then somebody else said, oh, no, we're, you know, it's as you were and everything. You don't have to be a big fan for capitalist industry to say, well, this is no way to run a railroad. You can't plan investment if you keep on flip-flopping like Keir Starmer does. Now, it's not true to say that the failure to invest in North Sea, and in fact Irish Sea and other parts of the sea, oil and gas, endangers our energy security. It's not quite so simple. We can talk about what Miliband actually also says, which is that, you know, we're handing our energy regime to nasty dictatorships abroad. So that's why we want wind and solar power, because it'll inoculate us from that, which is rather odd given it's China that's the source of a whole lot of that technology. But it may not endanger energy security. It will certainly endanger a lot of jobs. And it is just born of a upper class naivety and a refusal to do the research, even at the level of, I would say, GCSE physics.
I want to come back to the jobs question in just 1 second. But on the broader picture, it does seem like this government, not a million miles away from the previous government, are very much moving towards renewable energy and sort of suggesting that fossil fuels have had their day and that that's actually going to be something which is going to be phased out within years rather than decades. Just on that specific point, it's something that we write about a lot, but if to put it in a nutshell, why is that not the answer to our energy needs, to just go all in for solar and wind and to allow oil in the North Sea to go untapped as we go forward?
You know, it's a commonplace that wind and solar are intermittent because we have although we're an island and get quite a lot of wind by global standards, there are times, particularly in the winter, when the wind is completely dropped and it's cold, it's cloudy, you don't get any renewable energy. Now, some idiot from Greenpeace has said, well, there's always wind going on somewhere in the British Isles. Well, this is great. You know, it chiefly comes from Greenpeace. But the problem is it's not enough to, you know, keep industry alive. It just won't do. Now, a second thing that's often said, and it's right, is that in order to deal with intermittency, you need a whole lot of gas backup, because gas is easily dispatchable in a way that not all nuclear power is. And you need all of that to compensate for when, you know, the wind doesn't blow and all of that. That's very true. The thing that's emerged in the last few months is just how much fiddling you will have to do with the national grid, the actual transmission system for electricity, to handle all the balancing that has to take place between the renewables on the one hand and gas and nuclear on the other hand. You have to do a very big lash up with lots of rubber bands. And I think the latest estimate by National Grid just out today, which I might return to, is that it's going to cost $58 billion between now and 2030. That's quite a lot of money, $10 billion a year. It's not so much compared with GDP, but in terms of state expenditure, just to keep the lights on, it's quite a problem.
Absolutely. And Chris, what have you made of the green announcements from Labour so far?
Well, I think Miliband seems to be a bit fanatic on this particular issue, but he's not the first person in that position to be like that. I just don't care. I've never have cared about climate change. Not that I deny it or anything like that. I just don't care. And I am in the majority of the world. The Chinese don't care. The Indians don't care. The Brazilians don't care. The Russians don't care. The Americans don't really care. No one's ever going to do anything about it. So I don't see any point worrying about it. I think it's much more likely that the whole world will be blown up by nuclear weapons anyway, long before this becomes a problem. I've been told that global warming's a, you know, imminent threat all my life, basically, and I'm nearly 50, and nothing has really changed that I can see. I know they said we had the hottest May ever this year. Well, if that's, you know, that's the hottest May ever and they're all going to be like that, fine. You know, it can be hotter, a lot hotter than that, as far as I'm concerned. It was cold. I never had my window open the entire month. So on that basis, I conclude that it's not a problem. No, I do genuinely. Yeah, I hate to see these kids coming out of school all upset, thinking that they're going to die in a few decades due to climate change. They won't. They'll die in a nuclear winter, very likely. In all seriousness, we've got lucky with nuclear weapons for 80 years. But to paraphrase the IRA, you know, you only need to be unlucky once. The more people get their hands on nuclear weapons, Putin's not far off using them, I don't think. As soon as some Islamist gets hold of them, it's game over. Mutually assured destruction is the name of the game when it comes to suicide bombing. So I think people need to accept that life as we know it is going to be over sooner or later, if not in my lifetime, then in my children's lifetime. And therefore, there was no point worrying about what the climate's going to be like 100 years.
Well, briefly, to move it away from the IRA and nuclear winter, James, just on the question, because we talked about it earlier about green jobs. One thing reading your piece that I was quite struck by was just how few jobs there are, relatively speaking, in a lot of this renewable energy. I think you said even offshore Wind, which is presented as a big success story, something like 11,000 of the sort of full-time positions, vastly dwarfed by kind of other industries and other energy sources and so on. Is this claim that Labour are making therefore just complete nonsense? So not only is this going to be a green energy revolution, it's going to be a jobs revolution and economic transformation as well. Does that just not stack up, essentially?
Well, it is complete nonsense. I mean, that figure that I quoted, 11,000, is from the Office for National Statistics. They're not always reliable nowadays, but it's fairly reliable. And that covers, so they say, all the jobs, not just the people in the nacelles, which is the little control centre inside a typical wind turbine, but all the jobs, the, you know, the construction ones, the cementing, you know, the steel, you know. So I suppose the popular perception, or the vulgar perception, I should say, even though I'm a populist, that, you know, there's no labour costs associated with renewables, is grounded in the fact that, you know, they don't have a whole lot of labour attached to them, you know, once they're installed. You do have to have maintenance. That's being supplanted by robots going up and down wind turbines. So, you know, when Miliband told Scotland last year, I think it was, or early this year, that there's hundreds of thousands of jobs there, you know, you've got to ask, is he being mendacious or can he add up? You know, it's quite extraordinary how he can't do that. If I can return to the point I was just touching on before, he maintains that by going natural, so to speak, or, you know, what we often talk about as unreliables rather than renewables, you know, we will no longer be reliant on nasty regimes like Putin. Well, when we stopped all imports from Putin in December 2022. And if you look at oil, only 15% of our imports are covered by people like Saudi. And only 20% of gas is covered by people like Qatar. So we're largely independent of those nasty regimes. So he's raising another bogey, you know, in his, he hasn't done the numbers. He hasn't looked at the digest of UK energy statistics, which only a nerd like me would do, known as Dukes. But it's all there if you bother to look at it. It's clear that Miliband and Labour have not done their research. They are lawyers, you know, that's, and they believe, along with Joe Starlin, that if you write a piece of law on a piece of paper and call it a target, then everything else will happen. They just don't seem to see what the great military strategist Carl von Clausewitz talked about as the friction in war, the friction about in economics, the friction in physics. You know, life is tough. Things are intractable. You know, that you have to repair those gears. Nothing comes for free, and they just don't see that.
It does seem extraordinary to me that Keir Starmer, who has promised so little, really, and has been, you know, during the entire election campaign, was extremely cagey about saying what he was going to do, has still stuck to this ridiculous target of decarbonising the entire grid by 2030, which everybody Correct. Must know is impossible. You can't do anything in this country in 5 years, let alone the kind of building of pylons and it can't be done anyway, because, as you say, it's all intermittent. We're not building any nuclear power stations, and that's the only way to do it, unless you build a whole load of these stupid biomass things, which are technically carbon neutral, but they won't even be able to do that in 5 years. So this is something he absolutely cannot deliver on, and he must be intelligent enough to know that. And yet he's promised this. When the next election comes around, it's presumably going to be very close to 2030. They'll have got nowhere near it. I don't see the sense of him doing this, unless he's being either completely brainwashed by Ed Miliband, or it's one of these bloody targets that have been set in order for us to get close to it, get close to the date, get nowhere near the achieving the target, at which point it's like, well, we must double down, we must do this, this, and this now, because we're not achieving our target. And people like me would be going, well, I never set the bloody target in the first place. It's your target. I didn't agree to this. Same as I didn't agree to going smoke-free by 2030 or halving childhood obesity by 2030 and all these other stupid targets, which are usually just legacy promises by people such as Theresa May and Boris Johnson and now apparently Keir Starmer.
No. I mean, is it fair to say, James, that it's essentially just a sort of like religious faith amongst these people. They, even if they haven't necessarily got much of a grasp of the physics, as you say, if they haven't got much of a grasp of the science, this is just seemingly the thing that must be done if you're a responsible government? Like, is it just, unfortunately, just a matter of groupthink to a certain extent, that these targets must be set and they must be met?
Well, it's good you mention Theodore White's concept from the early 50s, groupthink, you know, because it has led to a lot of problems, not least getting quite close to nuclear war, to go to Christopher's point. But the thing is that I don't think it's the same as religion, because religion, for all its faults, has some sort of sense of transcendence, you know, of going beyond what we've got, not necessarily going back to a kind of feudal hair shirt regime. I think what's happening is, going to the groupthink, is that they are surrounded by SPADs, special policy advisors. They're surrounded by young people in think tanks. If you take Tony Blair's new report on AI, I have a photograph of him when he was in office, hunting and pecking with keyboards with two fingers. He knows nothing about AI, I can assure you. His advisors, who are probably 20-something, 30-something, were brought up on the climate change narrative, switching back to energy. And they tell him, look, you know, I've got a BSc and MSc in climate science, whatever that is, exactly. And, you know, I'm telling you, Sir Keir or Sir Tony, that, you know, if we're to avoid the apocalypse, and there the religious connotation does come through, everything must be subordinated to that. So it is the apocalyptic vision. Now, I'm a lukewarmer. I learnt this term fairly recently. I do believe that CO2 and industrialization generally in the 20th century is a rebuke to denialists. But that's one thing. It's another thing to say we face a climate emergency, that we should spray even Teslas, as demonstrators have done in Hamburg just recently, like they always spray monuments on near Parliament with orange. It's another thing to say it's an emergency, but if you really believe that the world is going to end, then everything has to be subordinated to that goal.
Absolutely. And Chris, while we're on the subject of a lot of bad or misunderstood statistics, should we turn to the sort of, I suppose, the junk science section of this podcast, where you look at some of the more ridiculous studies in the world of public health and nanny statism that have come out? Let's start with one that you've picked, which is this claim that I believe appeared in The Guardian, that, or at least heavily implied in The Guardian, that as a result of the sugar tax, sugar consumption amongst children had halved.
In 1 year, yes.
Is that true?
No, of course it wasn't true. Of course it isn't true. And it wasn't even implied. It was explicitly stated in the headline that within a year of the sugar tax being introduced, sugar consumption by children had halved. Now, in the text of the article, that was slightly downgraded to sugar consumption from soft drinks had halved within a year, but that was also untrue and pretty hard to believe, really, if you have any common sense about you. They later on changed the headline to say that the children's sugar consumption had halved a year after the announcement of the sugar tax, which was very slightly closer to what the study has said, but still totally wrong. What actually happened is that sugar consumption by children from soft drinks halved roughly between 2008 and 2019. The sugar tax didn't even come in until April 2018, and there was no real change in the direction of travel after 2018. There was at some point around 2015, 2016. It's a bit unclear from their graph, which looks a little bit gerrymandered anyway. But at some point, basically when everybody was banging on about the evils of sugar and every newspaper was going on about how it's a new tobacco action, sugar carrying on, Asim Malhotra was carrying on, Jamie Oliver and all these people, there may well have been a slight decline in the number of sugary drinks that being purchased, but no more than that. And the sugar tax itself had no impact whatsoever. The very idea that any policy really, but let alone an 8p tax on a can of Coke, was going to halve children's overall sugar consumption within 12 months is so absurd that it's extraordinary that I guess that people at The Guardian believed it, and they assume their readers are going to believe it. It's not, as I say, what the study said. As poor as the study was, it didn't make that claim. Perhaps the press release was more misleading, I don't know. But we're getting to the point now, and we'll see this again in the second example, that people are just saying anything now without engaging their brains for a second and assuming people are going to believe it. And I guess a lot of people do believe it.
No. And if it fits the narrative, then yeah. is all that counts. What did you make of this story, James?
Well, I think Chris is right on it. You know, the Trump and co always hated the media. I'm coming over to their side on that thing, because I think the media is what politicians respond to. It's the media that set agendas a great deal. This is different from the "it's the media" protests that the left used to make under Thatcher when I was living then. But it really does have a power, and therefore, you know, the soundbite, the tweet, is what substitutes for thinking, as Chris hints. You know, that's a problem. The second thing I'd say is that the left-right bogus distinction, it's an 18th century concept that comes from the French Revolution, hardly appropriate for the 21st century, is mirrored in the idea that all politics, Labour versus Tory, is about tax versus spending. You know, more tax, less tax, and so on. And therefore, the doctrine that, you know, as Chris says, 8p will actually determine human behaviour only confirms, you know, Wilde's famous remark that these people and all these wonks, policy wonks, know the price of everything and the value of nothing, mm-hmm. you know. And they really think, like free marketeers, the most vulgar free marketeers, that, you know, price signals are really what makes the world go round, you know.
Because, mm-hmm. Chris, in the piece that you wrote about this particular study, you point out that what sugar consumption peaked in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So we've had this narrative, this campaign for certainly more than a decade now around sugar being the big evil. It's something which, you know, it kind of plays on people's prejudices of all these horrible snacks that people will be feeding their children and so on. But just the underlying picture is completely set against that, it seems like.
Yeah. And, you know, people read this study properly and learned the proper lessons from it. What they would infer, I think, is that, wow, sugar consumption actually has come down quite a bit. I'm just talking about the sugar consumption from soft drinks when I talk about the halving, but actually there's a very significant decline in sugar consumption amongst kids and adults overall from food and from soft drinks. But this, as I say, did not start in 2018. This started way in the 70s, in the 80s. You know? And it's been a rocky road down, but basically the trend has been down. It's been very sharply down since about 2000. What has the trend in obesity been like over that period? Well, it's not been spiraling like people claim, but it's been gradually ticking up amongst, again, both adults and children. Now, I'm only half joking when I say that maybe sugar is actually the solution to obesity. You know, if you looked at the temporal trends, you would go, wow, sugar consumption keeps going down, obesity keeps going up. Maybe sugar is some sort of appetite suppressant or something. I don't know.
Subsidize it, you know.
Anyway, people have more or less forgotten about sugar anyway. Now it's all ultra processed foods. But I wouldn't be surprised if sometime in my lifetime somebody comes up with the old sugar diet and claims to have lost a huge amount of weight. But yeah, look, read objectively and looking at the graphs in this study, you should really. Whether or not you think the sugar tax announcement or the sugar tax itself had any effect on sugar consumption, you should conclude this is not having any effect on obesity. And it's one of a number of studies that's been coming out now with equally misleading headlines, which is probably now giving the median voter the impression that the sugar tax has worked when it absolutely has not.
And shall we move on quickly before we get onto our final and probably most controversial topic, to the question of smoking and claims made about it in relation to cancer? I know you wrote about this in The Critic in the past week.
Yeah, so Cancer Research, a very trusted organisation, so trusted that it now has realised it can get away with saying anything for a political cause. And eventually, I think, will start to chip away at its own reputation when people work out what it's doing. But it's been doing this now for a while, ever since it got involved with things like the plain packaging campaign for tobacco. It has been bending the truth. Now, at the IEA, when we put a report out, you know, it takes months and months to write, sometimes years. It then has to be peer-reviewed by two people, it gets re-edited, new draft produced, typeset, so on, press release.
Sent to your paymasters for changes.
Yes, that's indeed. And then it gets put out and we cross our fingers, hope that somebody notices it in the media. Cancer Research, this is not the first time this has happened, but this particular claim, and the claim is, folks, that the number of smoking-related cancer cases is at an all-time high in the United Kingdom. That was the claim. And that immediately is counterintuitive. You might go to the source. The source is just a web page on the Cancer Research website saying that, you know, this is some research we've done, which is yet to be published, but it is forthcoming. That's all it says. So you have to kind of take their word for it. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not going to take your word for it, because this is almost completely impossible. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine any scenario in which the number of smoking-related cancer cases is an all-time high when the number of smokers is an all-time low. Now, of course, there is a lag period between people smoking and people getting cancer, but that lag period is about 25, 30 years. And you can see this beautifully, actually, on a number of graphs from any country you choose to name. In Britain, as in many other countries, smoking rates went up first amongst men, went up very, very high to about 80% in the 1940s, went up later on amongst women. And in both cases, they came down again. And if you map the smoking rates against cancer, lung cancer cases in particular, which of course is most of the cancers, you see the perfect, you know, reflection a few decades down the line. We get up and down, up and down. And the decline in Britain amongst men of lung cancer started, I think, in the 70s, you know, and it's been going down ever since quite steeply, again, in line with the decline in smoking rates. Now, that's just lung cancer, of course, but as I say, it's the most common form of smoking-related cancer, and all the other cancers follow more or less the same pattern. There's a similar lag period, right? So it is just impossible, unless the population had gone up by a factor of 10, right? Or if cigarettes somehow suddenly got much more dangerous, which they haven't. They're the only scenarios in which you could possibly justify the claim that the number of smoking-related cancers has hit an all-time high. It just hasn't. And I don't know if this research is ever published, whether they'll try and explain what they think's going on here. But it's just a lie. It's just obviously a lie. There are currently 6 million smokers in the UK, give or take. In the 70s, there were 18 million. You know, of course, we're not seeing a peak in cancer. The peak in cancer happened many, many, many years ago. Why would they say this? Because they want to railroad West Streeting into bringing in this ridiculous tobacco ban. Mm-hmm. And they know they can get away with saying these things, so they do. But really, shame on cancer research.
It's also a reminder that everyone seems to be a lot more fun in the 70s, it seems like. Oh. Cigarettes, sugar, yeah, sure. You name it. James, what's your reaction to this?
Well, in America, for reasons that I don't know but are no doubt fairly obvious, the Reds are the Republicans and the Blues are the Democrats. And whatever one thinks of Trump's pick for Vice President, J.D. Vance, he's actually, you know, hung out his red flag for the working class in America. And I think really what the cancer research stuff sort of says is, you stupid workers, we've been telling you not to smoke for hundreds of years. You're still smoking more than ever. We really hate you, you know, and so on. And all of these bans and measures are, you know, it's not the measure in itself. It's more the snottiness towards the working class that really grates. And, you know, we need to recognize that for what it is. But what they need to realize is we got it. You know, the working class watches television. It reads the papers. It knows that fags aren't such a great idea. It knows that sugar is not great for kids, right? They're not stupid. But nevertheless, they got to be told again and again. Really, it makes me very angry.
A never-ending story, definitely. Let's move on to our last topic for the day.
Another never-ending story, I suspect.
Well, it certainly seems like it. Lucy Letby. So the infamous serial killer, according to both a trial and a retrial. She's going to be in prison for the rest of her life. She's on a whole life order, having been found guilty.
15.
Was it 15 whole life orders? Was it found guilty of the murder of 7 babies, the attempted murder of 7 more? And despite this being the original trial, certainly the longest in English history, I believe, something which went on for a very long time, very incredibly thorough, huge amount of evidence and expertise put before a jury, and they found her guilty, not of all counts, it's worth saying, but enough to put her away for the rest of her life. And yet, Chris, there has been this response, first of all, kind of in the blogosphere and online, but increasingly in the mainstream media as well, starting with an infamous New Yorker piece a few weeks ago through to now The Guardian and The Telegraph, basically making the case that this isn't all it seems, that perhaps she has been the victim of a grave injustice, that this was a case which hinged, as they would see it, entirely on kind of statistical coincidence rather than anything more clear-cut than that, and that what we could be looking at here is an incredibly grave miscarriage of justice. This is something that you've written about on your Substack a couple of times, kind of looking at the evidence and pushing back on some of the some of the claims. You want to tell us a little bit about this whole phenomenon? Because it seems to have doubled in size, at least, the kind of truther world, shall we say, since we last touched on it on the podcast.
Yeah, it's really exploded. And I think what happened is the New Yorker piece, because it couldn't be officially read in this country, but in actual fact was extremely easy to read, created a sort of Streisand effect around the whole thing. And the reporting restrictions, which have been in place for most of the last year since she was convicted, have led to people sort of discussing it furtively. And it turns out there's been a whole lot of skepticism that's been kind of bottled up and has now come out. So it was no great surprise to see, you know, the New Yorker piece itself actually wasn't particularly amazing. It really just rehashed what Letby's defense lawyers were saying at the time, in fact, really. Peter Hitchens has been a long time simp for her for some reason. And he was straight out of the blocks as well once the reporting restrictions were lifted. And yeah, blogs and various other people. But the surprising thing was, all of a sudden, you had the Telegraph and the Guardian and the Independent all come out with pieces that were basically quite pro Letby, certainly, you know, an appeal or a retrial, all based on the same kind of stuff. And look, I do get it. The reason I'm so interested in this case and I've kind of learned a reasonable amount about it is because I wondered myself whether she might be innocent. It's a very fascinating case. It really is, because it is circumstantial, and the prosecution made it very clear it was circumstantial. And circumstantial really just means we have a series of coincidences here. And there are so many coincidences, and the coincidences are increasingly unlikely that you put them all together. What do you think really happened? That's the question. I was on a jury a few years ago, and it was pretty much a circumstantial case. And with such a case, you can pick apart any individual piece of evidence and say, well, either that this could be a coincidence or that this, what if that's wrong, right? The thing is, you've got to make a strong case. And bear in mind, there were 22 separate charges here, all of which had different individual pieces of evidence. You have to use your own judgment. So I am more than happy to see this discussion, out in the mainstream, and let's discuss it, because obviously there's always a possibility anybody could have been wrongly convicted. But, you know, the Hitchens approach is, well, what if this lady has been wrongly convicted? Well, obviously it would be a terrible miscarriage of justice, wouldn't it? But that, you could say that about literally every case where someone's been convicted. What is it about this case that makes you feel so very strongly about it? And I think it is that people really haven't read up enough about the case. It's a shame that the transcripts are not available online, because people say all sorts of different things about it. It's quite hard to prove or disprove what they're saying. But there is enough out there for people to hopefully get this idea out of their heads that basically there was a spike in the number of deaths in this hospital, which could easily have just been one of those things, right? And they just hauled Letby in and worked out which cases she was on duty for and discharged her with those and told the jury, well, she was the only one there, therefore it must have been her. That really wasn't the case, right? They didn't spend 10 months showing the jury a spreadsheet and go, well, could this be a coincidence?
They could have done that in 10 minutes, just got the rotor.
Exactly. It was extremely in that case with all sorts of different bits of evidence, some stronger than others. Some of the charges were stronger than others. And that's why, in fact, that she wasn't convicted of all of them. If it had just been a case of, well, she was there, she must have done it, they would have convicted them all of them, wouldn't they? Now, I could go on about this at length, but I mean, I'll leave it at that for now. But I just beseech anyone who wants to go out batting for someone who is currently the worst child serial killer in British history to maybe don't just ask, what if she's what if she's innocent? Ask what if she's guilty as well. No. Maybe you don't want to be spending years trying to defend someone if she isn't in fact guilty.
And it is interesting the grounds on which people challenge it, because as you say, there is this sort of implication or claim that this is purely down to essentially negligence on the part of the hospital in question, or that there was some sort of claims about kind of sewage system malfunction which had led to all of these deaths, completely ignoring the fact that in each case you've got experts coming in and talking about the specific cause of death, how unlikely it was, the fact that you had clinicians and doctors.
It comes down, ultimately, if you boil down these people's objection, it comes down to there must have been a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. That's what it ultimately boils down to. Because if you deal with anyone who actually knows a bit more about it than their suspicion this is a Texas sharpshooter fallacy, they ultimately have to go, well, all these people who gave this testimony, they're lying. It's really what it comes down to. And it will come down to a conspiracy of, well, the hospital wanted to cover up all these deaths, so they invented a serial killer, which doesn't make any sense anyway. It's like not really portraying the hospital in the best light.
And her own defense conceded that the babies were poisoned. It's just not that it was necessarily her. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the skeptics have an answer for all of this, you know, and they'll say, well, the insulin evidence was weak and the evidence of air embolism was weak and this expert was wrong and that expert was wrong and the defense was terrible. But this then becomes this enormous set of coincidences, you have to believe. Do you mean that everything about the defense case was terrible? All the prosecution witnesses were either incompetent or lying. And that then just becomes this incredible string of, well, really, could all these things go wrong for her to be convicted? You know, it seems in a way more incredible than the fact that she was committing these crimes.
And I do like, it's not a new point, but I do like the sort of claim that the best way to avoid a kind of PR disaster of so many deaths in your neonatal care is to suggest that a serial killer has been on the loose amongst your own
staff. Show the Countess of Chester Hospital in his best light, having a serial killer marauding around.
But as you say, it's a complicated case. It rests on a lot of circumstantial evidence. People will have different views. But James, where do you stand on this particular question? I suppose the debate around it as well.
I think Chris has been characteristically very cogent. I mean, I would like to put in a word for agnosticism, really. You know, we don't hear enough about it. I'm partisan about agnosticism a bit because I'm no hospital expert, I'm no medical expert, I'm no legal expert. I do know that NHS trusts are often culpable because they're not in the soup and in trouble all the time and being sued for nothing, right? And I've had my own experience polemicizing against Epsom and St. Helier. And I can tell you, I've got zero confidence in that trust. They are mean to whistleblowers. They blame hospital staff, at the same time, on the other hand, you know, we know that the conspiratorial mindset, the truther mindset, is everywhere about everything. And it sells newspapers, it sells tweets. So I'm divided on the question. I read the Telegraph account, not as assiduously, it was late at night, as Chris has clearly read the New Yorker account. And I have to say, it did seem for a moment late at night that they had selected the dates at which, if I have it right, on statistics, they selected the dates when Letby was present. They found deaths on those dates. Therefore, you know, that was the story, and she was culpable. And it did seem that there were other dates where she hadn't been present, where people, her kids had died, babies had died. Now, I might have got it wrong, and saying I might have got
but
it
they
wrong.
Weren't, they were, the point was, they weren't suspicious deaths.
Well, fair enough.
And there were very few of them, right? You expect a baseline of a certain number of deaths. Mm-hmm. There was only two or three, except for the year or two where Letby was at the hospital. What the police did, they didn't try and fit her up, which is basically what they're suggesting, by saying, well, they found the dates that she was there and charged her for those. They got some independent experts to look through the history and say, point us to the ones you think are suspicious. Each of those, at the time, 14 cases were then handed to an individual detective who looked at them in isolation. When those detectives then came and met up with each other, they all realized that they had the same suspicions about the same person. That's how they did it. They started with the suspicious deaths and investigated. They didn't start with when was Letby on duty. Let's just look at those and ignore the rest.
Very good.
The rest of them wouldn't have been suspicious.
Very good. Well, I hear you. You know, I think... you know, in this week of after the Trump business and so on, and even connected with energy questions, we have to recognize that political opponents, or in this case, judicial opponents, are people who say that the judiciary got it wrong and so on. The judiciary in this country, like the hospitals, can get it wrong, as we know from a number of cases. People who say that, we have to be tolerant towards them, even if they are truthers, and not say that they are worse than opponents, they are enemies, right? We can't afford to do that. That's going to poison the debate. However, I think the strongest thing that I would say about it is when I read the Telegraph account, I was convinced of it a bit. When I read Luke Gittos' article, I was convinced of that a bit. And therefore, I say I'm agnostic about it because it's quite tricky. You know, on balance, I would support Luke. I wouldn't be against another appeal, costly though it would be, just to be absolutely sure. But then Chris will say, you know, it's all been done and dusted, you know.
No, I wouldn't say that. I'm happy for the big appeal, but you need to have good grounds for appeal.
Yeah.
And people who don't really understand the case going like, oh, well, this is Texas sharpshooter. That's not grounds for appeal because the defense has already been through this. They don't seem to realize that most of the quibbles that people have with the case were already brought up by the defense. And you can't have an appeal if something's already been brought up.
Yeah. But what about the criterion of beyond reasonable doubt? Is that relevant?
Well, what is, in fact, the criterion of reasonable doubt? What does it mean? You know,
And a point that Luke made, actually, which is important, I think, or useful in this context, was that a lot of cases, even ones where you're talking about murder, serial murder and so on, do end up being circumstantial. That is just the nature of it.
Right.
You know, it's very... It's not necessarily the case.
Always catch people red-handed.
No, exactly. With literally the smoking gun in
although
their hand.
Although they kind of did on a couple of occasions, even with the Letby thing, really. But it's a very good question. What is reasonable doubt? Is it 99%? Is it 90%? Is it, you know, somebody...
Telegraph
just said it was 50% the other day.
The Telegraph account contained nothing about insulin or injections, right? So what
it
you
missed
have,
a lot out of the
time. No, well, exactly.
It showed a post-it note, but it didn't show the I am evil, I did this post-it note, which is fairly significant.
Read one piece of the jigsaw, quite convincing. You read another piece, quite convincing. You know, but the intercourse between the two... is only understood by Christopher and a few other clever people.
Well, I don't claim to be an expert. I was listening to the Trial Lucy Letby podcast again just today, and I listened to the summing up of the prosecution, and I thought, well, she definitely did it. Then I listened to the summing up of the defense, and said, oh, she probably didn't. So, don't ask me. But then I wasn't on the jury for 10 months. I wouldn't have liked to have been, but I certainly would have known a hell of a lot more about it if I had. And certainly Sarah Knapson at the Telegraph.
And that is a useful point as well, to have some trust in juries, not least when they've sat through months and months and months of this evidence and this expertise.
Two juries.
James, we're fast running out of time. But before we let you go, we just want to ask you one question. If you had to have one ban, what would it be? Because we're quite a libertarian anti-ban podcast, we like to put our guests on the spot and kind of ask them in a sort of hypothetical dictator for the day situation, if that's to get rid of one thing.
Pieces of luggage.
Yeah, wheelie suitcases.
Wheelie suitcases.
You know, people might not like cycling. It's a sort of, it has to be something quite petty, something that just irks you, not something too kind of principled or grand.
So it's basically Room 101. If you're familiar with that show, but that's essentially
people have chosen VAR. It's that kind of level that we're asking for. So if you had to have one, what would it be?
Well, I fear mine isn't petty enough, but just coming here, I went to the tube and I nearly tripped over a parked kind of Boris or Barclay bike. And, you know, I'm not blind quite yet, but I think that though people who park them, you know, in an outrageous fashion in front of old people, in front of a tube, and then there was a whole rack of them as well. I don't mind the rack so much if anybody was using them. I'm not sure they are. But it really is antisocial to leave them for anybody to trip over, you know, and usually lying flat on the ground and just waiting to, you know, inflict injury. So it's a little bit serious rather than petty. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether an 8p bike tax would fix it.
Half usage.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm sure.
And I'm all for tolerance, but I think it's pretty bad. And the point I always make, like litter, because it's a metallic, large metallic form of litter, is I don't believe it's nostalgic for the old working class 50 years ago, that if a child did that or an adolescent, they get a cuff across the ear from their dad. You know, I'm not against that. Bring it back, the cuff on the ear, you know. And I think a judge has just decided that that's not child abuse or smacking.
Yes,
That solved a lot of potential problems for Chris.
So one ban and one law repeal. Super. One in, one out.
Exactly. James, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.